a lot of people will tell you within the community of adoptees, you know, our life doesn't start the day we were adopted. There's this whole other time and space and family that existed prior.
Society in general, they don't really understand the implications of adoption. They just feel, well, you were adopted, problem solved.
I knew I couldn't stay where I was or keep living with that grief. So moving through it was the only option.
I know in African culture, that's extremely important that you're able to put yourself into, they call it the flow of time. And it feels like that my lineage has been cut with my adoption.
There's such value in being in community among other adoptees, and it was validating for me. So that really helped for me to get connected, and then seems as if the world just opened up.
If I'm the secret that everybody has held for 37 years, you know, who can I talk to? And finally, it just hit me. I have a choice here. You're affected from the moment it happens. You're impacted. But I needed to know that I was going to be able to come to an understanding and a reconciliation.
You may have wondered what reunion looks like from an adoptee's point of view, or be embarking upon taking that journey yourself to search for your first family, or simply want confirmation that you are not alone in your experience. It's Jennifer Diane Gostin, and welcome to Once Upon a Time in Adoptee Land. Wouldn't it be empowering to have many of your burning questions answered here? My guest today is currently on a book tour as the published author of Who is a Worthy Mother? An Intimate History of Adoption. She was able to pause long enough during her current schedule to have a meaningful conversation with me for you. Her name is Rebecca Wellington, affectionately called Becca, not Becky. She is an adoptee living in West Seattle and happy to share with us a part of her relinquishment and adoption journey. At the time of this recording, Rebecca had recently returned from the Untangling Our Roots Summit held in Denver, Colorado. It was the first time that she had been to an event of that kind, and she gives us a peek into what that experience was like for her. In this episode, she also delves into the why of writing her historical memoir, what being on the other side of getting her story out into the world feels like, and what she wants the reader to garner from weaving her lived experience as an adoptee with the history of adoption. Rebecca holds a doctorate in education history from the University of Washington, where she taught in the undergraduate program of the College of Education. Her career in education started on the ocean, sailing around the world on a traditionally rigged tall ship. Through this 2-year global circumnavigation, Rebecca trained for a U.S. Coast Guard captain's license and went on to work in nonprofit outdoor education, teaching kids to sail on the Charles River in Boston, and later on the Puget Sound of Washington State. Her scholarly articles have been published in the History of Education Quarterly, the American Indian Quarterly, and the Pacific Northwest Quarterly. During the recording with Rebecca and when reading her book, I was particularly struck by her passion for holding space for her dear sister, Rachel. Allow me to introduce to you someone who was driven to write a history of adoption in the United States from the perspective of an adoptee and to honor the memory of her older sister, Rachel, and truth of brave women everywhere. She has come to understand after a deep dive into adoptee land how traumatic relinquishment is for the birth first mother and the adoptee. It is through her beautiful and painful words that the reader of Who is a Worthy Mother comes to better understand that too. Rebecca, I am so happy to have this conversation with you today. And I know you like to be called Becca instead of Becky, right?
Yes, not Becky.
Not Becky.
Not Becky.
Well, Becca, I know you're in West Seattle. So tell me how you're doing there today.
I'm good. I just shared before we started, we had a brief conversation. I just got home from the Untangling Our Roots conference out in Denver. Got home last night, so I'm really happy to be home today and see my family and sort of heading off on my book tour. So I'm really enjoying the time I have when I'm home right now.
Right.
So it's really nice to be home.
How exciting to be on a book tour. And before we get into your book, which I so enjoyed, Who is a Worthy Mother? An Intimate History of Adoption. Well done. I really appreciated how you weaved in your relinquishment and adoption story, along with so much rich history regarding adoption. But before we get into that, and congratulations on that achievement.
Oh, thank you.
I'm happy that you brought up the Untangling Our Roots Summit, because I understand that's the first type of event of that kind that you've been to. So tell me what that experience was like. And it's so fresh. You just got back.
Oh, yeah. It was so intense. I work in academia. And so every conference I've been to, I've gone to a lot of conferences in my professional life. And they're all academic conferences, you know, with historians and educators. So I kind of was in conference mode, and I walked in there, and it was unlike anything I'd ever experienced, because it was so different from the academic conferences I'm used to going to. And I've shared this, I think, with you before. I have never really been out public about being adopted. I'm really new to this space. When my book got accepted for publication about a year and a half ago through the University of Oklahoma Press, that was the first time I realized, oh, I really have to start identifying myself as adopted. And I changed my social media titles to adoptee, which was like, I was like, oh my God, I'm identifying as adopted. And since the book's, you know, started the launch, you know, and I've been doing interviews and things, I'm identifying as adopted for the first time in my life. And I have never been in a space with so many adopted people ever in my life. Like my friends that I've grown up with, my community, I don't know adopted people. You know, I've come across paths with some adopted people, but I never spent a lot of time, you know, with a lot of adopted people. And so walking into that conference was really intense for me. It was really good, but it was overwhelming on a lot of different levels. So
it usually is. Yeah. It usually is very overwhelming and overstimulating. I'm talking even after you've been to many of them. So that was to be expected.
Yeah. You know, in academic conferences, people will come up to you and they'll say, where do you teach? You know, what's your university? Where'd you get your doctorate? You know, it's sort of this, you know, there's a lot of ego when you got a lot of PhDs in the room. I'm kind of comfortable with that. And at this conference, people would come up to me and the first question was, tell me your story. Like, oh my God. I'm like, wait, we got to sit down. How much time do you have? Like, I don't, you know, and then people would walk up to me, have you found your birth parents? And I'm like,
Right. I'm glad you're sharing that. Yeah.
It was really, I loved it. And I felt really, you know, I felt like I was with my people in a lot of ways. I felt really connected with the stories people were sharing. And hearing those stories really normalized a lot of things that I've found really hard in my own life. And so I walked away from the conference feeling like, I'm okay, you know, I'm normal, you know,
right.
And I'm not like perfect. I have a lot of things that I've gone through, but there are a lot of other people walking around who have been through similar things. And that was really, really, that was like, you know, having a nice warm blanket put over my shoulder.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And you're right. The questions are, I would imagine, very different than you would get at an academic conference.
Yeah.
Especially when I reflect, I just remember hearing quite a bit, well, what member of the constellation are you? And sometimes the terminology within the community is not known right away. Like you're still learning terms and the words that are used to describe different things. And that's a really good point to make. As you're being approached by people, they're calling upon you to like identify yourself as it relates to adoption. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you got a chance to hang out with Sarah Easterly, right?
Yes. Sarah is really the first person, you know, actually the first person who really reached out a hand to me when I started writing. I was like halfway through my book manuscript. I reached out to Susan Harness because I just read Bitterroot and her incredible adoption memoir. And I really wanted to integrate her story into my book. And so I connected with her and she just reached back and grabbed my hand and said yes. And she has just been such an amazing support and ally in this project. And then she, Susan Harness, connected me with Sarah Easterly through the adoptee writing group. And just both of those women are just like, they're like angels. They're amazing. Very grateful for both of them.
Yeah, I appreciate both of them so much. And you spent quite a bit of time talking about Susan Harness in your book in the beginning. And it warmed my heart because her book I so enjoyed and I learned so much. So yeah. I was happy to see that. And you were able to be with Sarah and Susan with the group on the page. What was that experience like?
Oh, that's been really wonderful. I'm still part of that group. And it's a group for adoptee writers. And I joined after my book manuscript was in. So I haven't been writing with the group, but it's been just a wonderful support group talking about the book, just book publication as a process. Susan Ito is in the group and she just has been on an epic book tour with her phenomenal book, I Would Meet You Anywhere, which is, I highly recommend. And so it's just been such a blessing as I'm launching my book to be in community with these incredible writers, you know, and Sarah Easterly's book with Laurie Holden and Kelsey Vandervliet Rainyard, Adoption Unfiltered, is phenomenal. And their book published, I believe, in December 2023. So also a very recent publication. So I just feel like I'm in community with these other just amazing adoptee writers who are just two steps ahead of me and giving me a lot of love and support and guidance.
Yeah, I love everything you said there. Yeah, I'm definitely in close community with Sarah because she created Adoptee Voices. And I co-facilitate there with her, Alice Stevens, and Kate Murphy. So I can only imagine that was a really meaningful experience to be working with her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to give a shout out to Alice Stevens. She has also, she's in the, on the page group, and she has been so supportive as well. And on the book tour, I will be speaking at Loyalty Books in Washington, D.C. with Alice on May 29th. And Alice made that happen. And I'm just so grateful for her as well. So,
shout out to Alice. Yeah.
Yay. Yeah.
That's great. And you'll be with Sarah.
May 2nd in Seattle at Third Place Books Ravenna.
Got it.
May 2nd. Yeah. So coming up just a few days away.
Yeah, the book touring's got to be exciting. I imagine it's exhausting as well, but in a good way, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Well, let's just get into your book. I have page 17, 22, 49, 99, 117, 146, 155, and chapter 5 I really sat with because of your sister, Rachel.
Yeah.
So I want you to
like take the lead, and then I will share with you what was so profound for me to read. Yeah. But I'm going to let you start. I hope you don't mind. From wherever you want to start, however much you want to share about who is a worthy mother.
Well, I like to just share what I call like the origin story of the book, because I think that's really interesting to know how it's, you know, what's the backstory for this? Because, you know, somebody said to me 10 years ago, you know, your first book you publish is going to be all about adoption and your childhood and your sister. I would have, like, you could have pushed me over with a feather. I would have been like, there's no way. That's, I'm not going to tell that story. So what's, I think, still really interesting to me about this book is it was not my plan to write it. And there's a part of me that's still kind of hesitant to share it, although I have to share it. And it's been a really painful process writing it and speaking about it, but it's also just profoundly healing. So the origin story, first, I was adopted in 1975 at 2 days old in the state of California. So that's the first part. And then I spent my whole life kind of not talking about adoption, not identifying as an adoptee, just working really hard to sort of pretend that that didn't exist and that just we're a normal family, everything's great. But the reality was there was a lot of hard things happening in my family through my whole childhood. But I thought if I could just kind of cover it up and assimilate and, you know, prove to my parents that I was a worthwhile purchase. I didn't think of it then, but now I realize, oh, it's really a transaction. Like, they purchased me, but I just wanted to be a worthwhile adoptee. Like, they got a good one, because I think a lot of what I felt growing up was that there was sort of this perception that maybe my sister wasn't a good one. So I wanted to be a good adoptee. So I sort of desensitized myself to a lot of things I was feeling subconsciously. And then in 2010, then in 2011, my two daughters were born. And to this day, they're the only people I've ever met who I'm biologically connected with. Only two people I've ever met who I'm have that blood connection. When they were born, both of their births, it was just so profound to meet, to carry a baby to term, give birth to it, and hold that baby and take that baby home. And I knew for the first time in my life that my birth was just profoundly traumatic for my birth mother and for me. And something I had been told my whole life was, you know, my birth mother walked into this huge hospital. She gave me away. It was the best thing she ever did. She just went on with her life. And everything's great. And I'm like, nah, there's no way that's not the truth. And then in 2017, my older sister, who is also adopted and who relinquished a child for adoption, she died of a drug overdose. That just kind of pushed me over the edge. And I, for the first time, really knew I needed to get answers about my adoption. Also to understand her and the trauma and grief that she really experienced as an adoptee and as a birth mother. And I just had a lot of doors closed in my face. As, you know, and this is one thing, you know, I really talked a lot about this when I was at the Untangling Our Roots conference, was just understanding how, you know, in certain states, birth records are still sealed, and the logistical policy challenges of unsealing records. It's a huge endeavor that some really amazing people are taking on. But unfortunately, in the state of California, there's the birth records, I think pre-1990, are still completely locked down. So it's virtually impossible for me to get access to my original birth records. I kind of, in a state of grief and confusion, turn to what I know I can do, which is historical research. My sister died 2 months after I completed my doctorate in education history at the University of Washington. So I was like, well, I have this skill set of reading a lot of history and writing about history. So I'll do that as a way to sort of calm myself down and get answers when I couldn't get answers about my own history. I was like, I need to get answers about why I can't get answers about my own birth story and my own ancestry.
I feel that throughout the pages. And
yeah,
it is heartbreaking for you not to even have your original birth certificate. And for me, many years was the case as well. And I know when I saw you mentioned Sarah Eigenholz on page 155, it took me back like to when Illinois finally opened the records to a degree where we could request our original birth certificates. Sarah had worked for at least 13 years tirelessly on having mm-hmm. that law change. And yeah, you reminded me when you wrote about her of what that was like here in, well, now I'm in Nashville, but in Illinois, where yeah. I was born. Yes. I felt through the pages of your book how you were uplifting and really celebrating mothers and women, you know, in a way that isn't often done, you know, beautifully described in the way you did. And I wanted to read something from page 146. Is that okay?
Yeah, yeah.
When people's lives in the past are silenced, this, in turn, silences people's lives in the present. But when these stories are told, it changes our understanding of the present world. When people's stories are shared, especially the lives of people who are deliberately traumatized and silenced, those awoken historical narratives directly affect the lives of people in the present. We start to view the world and our place in it differently. And then we actually start to act differently. And this, in turn, impacts the future. History is powerful. As were your words there. It gave me chills. It does right now.
I love that you read that quote, Jennifer, because that's the quote I was going to read. It's like, that's like my all-time favorite part of the book.
Is that right?
But I want to, there's actually the section before it. Can I read that part leading up to that?
Yes. Be my guest. Yes.
Okay. So I'll just add on. And this is the section right before that. This is really why I started this journey of writing this book. In her memoir detailing her search for her birth mother, Katrina Maxtone Graham describes adoption as, quote, an amputation from history, unquote. To heal the wound of this amputation, the silence and the lies that defined our lives, I had to reach out to those historical roots and threads and reattach them. History, the true stories of the past, became my way of speaking truth to power for Rachel, my sister, now that she had lost her voice in death. History is constantly sticking its fingers into our present everyday lives, whether or not we are aware of it. History has incredible power. It can paint pictures of where we came from and how the world and the people in it looked, acted, and believed. This is weighty because how we understand ourselves and the world around us in this current moment is largely defined and shaped by what happened in the past. This is the power of historical narratives and historical memory. So that was the section right before what you read. My all-time favorite part of the whole book.
So I hope I didn't screw that up. Were you going to read the whole thing?
No. I love that you got, but you nailed it. I'm really glad that was the part that you found so significant because, you know, I've always in my heart been a historian. I love history. I am a historian now. And it's because I firmly believe that. I understand how the stories we tell about the past define who we are, how we value each other, and what we're able to do in the future. And one thing I really realized in writing this book is that we live in such a mirage around adoption, around fertility, and around conceptions about motherhood and womanhood in America that are so incongruent with what actually happened. And it's because we have historical amnesia. There's so much we don't know. And so we believe lies. We believe untruths and really damaging misconceptions because we don't know the real past. And when I started researching the history of adoption policy and practice in this country, my first response was just horror that I didn't know that. I didn't know that history as a historian, you know? So I'm like, we have to know this if we're going to do things differently in the future.
Yeah, history is critical, like knowing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so important. I'm excited to read history. I want to know, yeah, like what happened before and before that and before that. And it's funny because when I was in school, particularly high school, I wasn't that fond of history. I don't think I had a consciousness of how important it is, but I certainly do now.
Yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned that you learned that the separation from mother and child was equally traumatic.
Yes.
Yeah, I would agree with that. In my almost 10 or 12 years, probably more like 12 years, of just doing a deep dive and learning more about the girls who went away. For example, I'm thinking of Anne Fessler's book.
Which I cite pretty extensively in my book. Yeah.
Yeah. Just talking with birth moms. I recently had Leslie Pate McKinnon on, and Laura Ingle has been on, and just spending time with birth mothers over several years and hearing their story, there's no doubt in my mind that it's truly a trauma that is like lifelong. And they describe only in reunion did they begin to feel a sense of the grief and the shame lessen, you know, or even go away.
And that we don't have a collective societal awareness of that is sort of looking forward. It's pushing really, really destructive practices and policies right now. In the end of the book, I talk about the passage of the Dobbs decision and think about the impacts of women being stripped of their reproductive autonomy and their reproductive rights. And part of that decision made by our Supreme Court was this assumption that women can just give their babies up if they don't want to, you know, if they're pregnant, they don't want to raise their babies, or they can't, or they don't have the resources. You can just give your baby up for adoption. Like Samuel Alito directly said that we're in short supply of adoptable babies. And then Amy Coney Barrett followed up. You can just give your baby up for adoption. This is a logical response to taking away women's reproductive autonomy. And they can make that judgment because they don't know. Maybe they do, but I think most people don't know and have a deep awareness of how traumatic it is for a woman to give birth to a baby and give it up. And so that's part of what the work that we need to do is and that you're doing, and a lot of amazing people bringing those voices to the fore, so that people can hear directly from women who have had to relinquish their babies, have been forced to relinquish their babies because they had no resources, no support, no options. You know, and I'm also thinking about Gretchen Sisson's great new book, Relinquished, which I highly recommend, detailing the last 10 years. She did this sort of longitudinal study interviewing mothers who had to relinquish their babies. And we have to understand that it's highly traumatic that if a woman gets to a point where she's walking into a hospital to give birth to a baby and give it away, she is in crisis, because so many things, systems, communities, people, institutions have failed her up until that point.
Yeah, thank you for saying all of that. On page 69, well, first I want to go back to like the beginning of your book, and you described this 2-year adventure. I think there's another word for what that must have been like.
But oh my God.
Yeah. I was like holding my breath, you know, I was like, what? You want to talk a little bit about that? And then I'll go into, like, I can't even, like, that sounds so frightening.
Yeah. It's all true. It all. I had spent a lot of time sailing. I grew up sailing here in the Puget Sound, in the Pacific Northwest. And I did an amazing program in undergraduate called Sea Education Association, and spent 2 months out on the North Atlantic on an incredible sailing ship. And so I always loved sailing, and I just sort of serendipitously found out about this crazy ship that was on a maiden voyage sailing around the world. And I had just graduated college, and I was in a job that I wasn't really enjoying. And I was really fortunate to be able to join on this insane adventure. So I signed on to this ship in the fall of 1997, signed on as paying crew to be trained as a sailor and a crew sea time that I would later use to sit for a Coast Guard license. I went on and worked a lot in nonprofit outdoor education, working on boats. And I did get a tiny captain's license, like the smallest one you can get, but it was a captain's license.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I accrued tons of sea time, but yeah, between fall of 1997 and 1999, I lived on a tall ship, which is like a Pirates of the Caribbean ship. That's what sort of in layman terms people know, a traditionally rigged bark, 3-masted bark, which is it's like a pirate ship. And we sailed around the world. It was crazy. The way I describe it, it's like, I think it's Tolstoy who said it was the best of times, it was the worst of times.
Yeah. it was a gift and a curse, right?
It was a gift and a curse. And I met my husband on the ship, some of the most important people in my life, who I'm still deeply connected with, who I just saw two of the most amazing crew members on our ship. Second mate, she and her husband, who was the bosun, I just saw them in Denver when I was at the Untangling Our Roots conference. Yeah, they're my ship family. So really important part of my life.
Well, I know your words on page 169, that first paragraph. I just sat with that. I thought it was just beautifully expressed. And you wrote, "The point of the lighthouse is to signify shallow water and hazards therein, particularly rocks. Lighthouses alert you to danger, but also allow you, in knowing the danger, to make calculated decisions and thus continue to adventure. In this sense, they provide freedom. They are guides. They don't lie. They speak the truth. No bullshit. A bright light in the night and a visibly coded tower seen in the day. And they emit a coded horn when visibility is low, so you can hear them even when you can't see them. You see them and hear them if you choose to look and listen. And if you choose not to listen or see, you do it at your own peril. Lighthouses are truth tellers, and they tell you what is underneath, what most of us cannot see, but can destroy us." And then you go on when you are at sea. And I loved how you described that experience.
Yeah, that was really also to honor these women who I call them my ship mothers, who were on the ship. Some of the most amazing friends and sisters and mothers. You know, I think one way I've survived is by sort of collecting mothers and sisters outside my immediate family who have supported me. And these women that I met on the ship really became such profound role models for me as women, as leaders. Most of them never had children, you know, and I wanted to sort of show them, shine a light on them for just how amazing they are as women and as leaders, but also to say, you know, kind of bringing it back to fertility, because fertility is such an important piece of the story, that I think we need to disrupt how we define mother and how we see women and how we see women's value as not so intricately tied to this very sort of heteronormative perception of, you know, what a mother is supposed to be. And I see these women as mothers to me, and most of them never carried babies in their belly or raised children, right?
Right.
They mothered in other ways.
Right. They mothered in other ways. Absolutely. And I really should have read the next paragraph. What I want to do, if it's okay, I'll read at the end of the second paragraph when you say, when I boarded a ship in the fall after graduating from college, I began a journey that would bring into my life women, ship mothers who, like lighthouses, would speak truth to power and guide me.
Yeah. Yeah.
All of that resonated with me. I know women who did not give birth but were mothering figures to me and still are. The mothering can come from so many different places, I believe. And so, yeah, I think your book expresses so well how women need to be regarded.
Yeah. Well, the other sort of part of my claim is that in order to sort of move forward in a way that is, you know, just and kind and equitable and true, is we need to just sort of dismember this very rigid binary about who's a good mother and who's a bad mother, right? Who's a worthy mother, who's not a worthy mother, and what it means to be a woman, right? I think that's at the root of a lot of the damaging things that happen in our society, that like deep, deep racism and misogyny that sort of are pervasive in our country, and sort of reframe what it means to be a mother.
How does it feel to be on the other side of writing?
It's a relief that it's done, because it was so hard to write it. It was really painful writing it. It was really painful to read this history. I had to read a lot of history that was really hard to digest. And I do feel like I'm really good at, this is one of the skills that I think I have, is to read a lot of sort of sterile academic writing and then put it into an approachable story, right? But to do that, which is what I really work to do in Who is a Worthy Mother, but to do that, you have to wade through a lot of really, really awful stuff and digest it and then repackage it. What was hard about it was, like, this was like my history, you know, as an adoptee, I'm like, you know, it was hard to read it and write it. And so I'm kind of exhausted and grateful that the writing part is over and it's getting out there, you know, because at the end of the day, the other thing is I wrote this for my sister, you know, and I wrote it to tell her story, to tell so many women's stories. But the initial impetus was to tell her story. Like, my husband just this morning looked it up and he's like, oh my gosh, Seattle Public Library has just ordered a bunch of copies. And like, I'm like, oh my God, like, that's just like It's going to be sitting in the Seattle Public Library. Like, that's my sister sharing her story.
Yeah.
And that's where I feel like it's like a sigh of relief, because that's why I wrote it. You know, she lived her whole life being, I think, misunderstood and then silenced and sort of written off as crazy and then silenced in her death. And so to know that her story is getting out there, that our stories are getting out there, I'm like, okay, it's a relief.
Yeah. Your adoptive parents, are they still alive?
They are, yes.
Have they read your book?
I don't know. They know about it.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy that you wrote it. I think that the more adoptees come forward and share their lived experience, we just have a better opportunity for mainstream to know the true narrative of an adoptee. And sigh of relief over here, too, that you're on the other side of it, because I know it is emotional labor. I think anytime we share our stories in whatever way, it's labor.
It is. It's a labor of love.
Well, I'm so glad we had this opportunity to chat today. And as we wrap up, is there anything that you want to share with me that I didn't ask?
I just always want to express my gratitude to the folks who are amplifying these stories. So I'm just so grateful that you are putting stories out like you just shared. You've been amplifying the voices of birth mothers and other people who, like you shared, who have been silenced. I'm just really grateful for the work that you're doing to share these stories, because that's how we change. That's how we change and move in a direction of love and integrity and empathy, is when we listen to each other. So I want to thank you for creating this space, Jennifer.
Thank you for being here with me, taking the time. And, you know, I had page 15 marked, and if it's okay, I would like to end with this that you wrote. The death of my older sister, Rachel, capsized the metaphorical boat that was my adoptive childhood family. Throughout my childhood, my sister was the one person who knew this secret, that being adopted was actually shameful. We never talked directly about it, but we talked and joked indirectly about it all the time.
You hit all the, man, Jennifer, you got all the awesome. You saw to the, you nailed it.
Well, it was your writing. It was your doing. And I just knew what I sat with. That was so meaningful. So thank you.
Oh, thank you, Jennifer.
I'm still holding space for Rachel's struggles as a relinquished and adopted person. Remembrance Day each year on October 31st is in honor of those adoptees we have lost or who suffer because of their hardships. I know firsthand that many adoptees can relate to Rachel's story in Rebecca's book of life becoming disastrous as a result of being separated from one's family of origin. Rebecca's painful account of being a witness to her sister's lifelong fight to be seen come alive in the pages of her book. It can be hard to witness another adoptee's consciousness. I appreciate Rebecca sharing her recent first-time participation at an event full of adoptees. The Untangling Our Roots Summit was well attended and a success. I've seen plenty of pictures to prove it. Many members from the Constellation have described it as overwhelming and overstimulating at times. Yet, one of the best experiences of sharing adoption stories and being in fellowship with others who don't require you to do a ton of heavy lifting when explaining the life of an adopted person. I mentioned having all these tabs in Rebecca's book, and most of them weren't covered during our time together. Therefore, I thought I would read from one of those pages that I had marked. It is on page 49, the second paragraph. When I was in high school, I started really wondering about my adoption and my birth family. For the first time, I started asking questions. One day, my mother took down a box from a high back shelf in the utility room behind our kitchen and pulled out an old, large, rusted plastic safety pin. She explained that it had been the pin on the cloth diaper I was wearing when they picked me up from the hospital to adopt me. That's it. That was the only relic I had in my life in the time before I was adopted. That safety pin was the only object that connected me to my birth and my birth mother. That's it. There's no paper trail, no pictures, no names, not even the name of an adoption agency. The whole transaction was so cagey that nothing remains except a safety pin. Sometimes even now I wonder if I really was born, because there is zero evidence of it happening. Even my birth certificate is fake, but I have to have been born because I am here. Thank you, Becca, for taking the precious gift of time during your fast-paced book tour to have this conversation with me. I trust you are enjoying the ride. I appreciated reading your book in preparation for our time together because of the style, flow, and wealth of information about your lived experience. I hope that others come to know you better through your words, just as I did. If you're an adoptee and would like to share your adoption journey, visit JenniferDianeGhostin.com. If you like Once Upon a Time in Adoptee Land, leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Follow and or give, hopefully, a 5-star rating so others can find it too. During the course of your day, I trust you will tell at least one friend or someone who you believe might find value in it, because word of mouth is still the very best way for the show to grow. Thank you for being here.